You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Today, we are at the Giro d'Italia.
Cozze, citene, cozze, cozze, piscine, non spicudeci cora, cozze, citene, cozze, cozze, piscine, non spicudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Hello, my name is... Actually, I don't know what my name is. Ricardo Risotto.
No.
Daniele Fribrancini. No.
Who did I hear the other day? I heard an American. You know the way Americans... This is not their fault. The way they pronounce risotto.
Yeah, risotto.
Oh, God. Yeah. I just want to dive in the Adriatic every time I hear that. Anyway.
Where are we, Daniele Fribrancini?
When well, I said we're I told all our dear American listeners, like I said, I know it's not. That's just the way you pronounce it in American.
Well done. It? I mean, about... close to 30% of our audience is American, so that's alienating.
And who's to say they're wrong? Who's to say they're wrong?
I think they're right. Listen, Daniel, this is a very special occasion. This is our press conference episode, first one of the Giro d'Italia.
I feel like I'm going on a game show, a quiz show, and you're very well prepared for this, and I'm not. I don't even know what the format of the quiz is.
Well, you haven't heard any of the questions. I've been running through a few of them. We've had a lot of questions. Thank you very much for all your questions. We're not going to get through them all. I do apologize, but we'll get through as many as we can. But this is a very special occasion. This is a surprise to you. This very episode is our 1,000th episode.
Oh, wow.
1,000th episode of the Cycling Podcast. Free to air, I think, is the caveat. So it doesn't include Friends specials, but... there we go. How about that? How do you feel about that?
Emotional. Very emotional.
You don't look very emotional. Starting in 2013.
I'm still trying to process it, Richard.
Quite a milestone, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Will you sing, I don't know, Happy Birthday? Is that appropriate? Not birthday, really, but some kind of song to recognise this at the end of the episode?
No, but maybe we'll celebrate.
Daniel, rest day. How have you spent your rest day?
Well, I've been working, haven't I? As you know, I've been. I had a mishap with my computer a few days ago, so I've had to borrow your computer. I've sequestered your computer the day, and I've been working on it all day.
Yes, it's and got your then fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, and then I went out for a run in the filthy weather. We're right on the coast where we're staying in San Vito Chietino, and it's been quite a wild day out there, hasn't it?
Very wild. Yeah, goodness, it wasn't raining this morning, but it's been pretty ferocious this afternoon. Which must be filling the riders with a certain amount of dread.
Although the forecast is not too bad. Although a few people I know have been looking at the forecast for the next week to 10 days today. Well, and also looking at what the temperatures are like up in the Alps today. You'll remember that we're going to the race is supposed to be going over the Stelvio. Bormio is the town at the bottom of the Stelvio, over 1,000 metres lower than the Stelvio. The temperatures were in the minus numbers, minus Celsius, that is, all day there today. Yeah, I was just talking to a couple of colleagues today, and among them, guys who ride a lot, and the consensus was that it's just going to be impossible to do 20 kilometer descents if the temperature is near zero at those altitudes.
I'm still a little traumatized by the spectacle at the finish yesterday of riders so cold. I've never seen riders that cold, and it was
between 8 and 10 degrees, and that was at the end of a climb. Obviously the body temperature is higher at the end of a climb. There was one substantial descent in yesterday's stage, but yeah, the temperatures were a lot warmer yesterday than they're set to be on some days.
Vincenzo Nibali and Jakob Fuglsang have both given press conferences today, and they both talked a lot about the weather and about the effects it might have on the course, but also on the riders and how clothing choices are going to be very, very important.
They talk much about each other?
No, they've put that to bed, apparently.
Nibali was on Rai television, Italian television, yesterday, bigging up how close the respective wives are. He says they're on the phone all the time.
Nibali and Mrs. Nibali and Mrs. Fuglsang,
who's a keen cyclist now.
She is. She's a keep fit fanatic, is she not? Anyway, should we dive straight into the questions? Daniel. Oh, before we do, just we've been trying to get an update on the Mark Cavendish situation. There isn't one, is the short answer. But he's down on the start list for Skelderpriest on Wednesday.
Yes, I would sort of reiterate what I said yesterday. At this stage, it would be speculation to suggest, you know, what he might have meant with his interview yesterday. I spoke to a few people today close to him, connected with him. You know, some of them thought that it was just a case of him being very emotional yesterday and possibly not meaning that he had the firm intention to retire. But we mentioned yesterday that things are moving at Bahrain McLaren. Staff changes, rider changes, riders' contracts being renewed, not being renewed. I think it's been a fairly intense few days as far as decisions or communicating decisions to the people that they will affect. Whether Mark Cavendish has been told in the last few days there's no place for him, I do not know.
Hey guys, so my question is, I'm a fan of other sports like NBA, NFL, and in those sports people are always talking about putting asterisks in the 2020 season because there are no fans in the stands, there is a bubble championship, etc. So my question is, do you think that we will look back in the future at 2020 and put some asterisks on the results, for example, of the Giro if a lot of riders leave the race because of COVID or if the last stages of the Stelvio and the Agnello are cancelled? Thanks a lot for your coverage, and I'm looking forward for this answer. Thank you.
Well, that was a question from Portugal, from Diogo Lopez, not about his country's great success at this Giro.
Perhaps Diogo's concerned, though. Perhaps he's concerned that if João Almeida holds on, that he won't get the recognition that victory would deserve.
Well, to his great credit, his question wasn't as quite as one-eyed as that. He seemed to have a wider concern about how we'll look back on the results this year. And I think most of them, I'm thinking of Julian Alaphilippe at the World Championship, you know, Pog at the Tour de France, there won't be an asterisk against those results, certainly. What happens at the Giro remains to be seen, of course. We're speaking the rest day. There were COVID tests today. We'll hear in a moment from one rider, Jos van Emden, who I spoke today, the Jumbo-Visma veteran, I think I can call him, who's always quite outspoken, with some pretty punchy comments about the Giro and COVID. We'll hear from him in a moment. But what's your thought? What are your thoughts on that, Daniel?
I think as regards to the Giro, it would depend who was forced to leave. If it's only Simon Yates, I mean, we don't really know to what extent he was affected by and his performance was affected by COVID symptoms. It may very well be that he simply wasn't going that well anyway. So it would take more riders, more GC contenders to be eliminated from the race for us to really pose that question. Fortunately, or very unfortunately, as far as we're all concerned, cycling has a rich history of results being caveated and asterisked.
History.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
It does.
You know, you can go back through the annals of cycling and there should be asterisks, not just by winners, but by a lot of what has happened in bike racing, in stage racing in particular. And it's simply not. And, you know, that creates some embarrassment when we talk about it years later. And it creates difficulty in evaluating and comparing, you know, riders and comparing eras. But we've learned to live with that, haven't we? And I think that will be the case with everything that's happened this year. I mean, I certainly think the integrity of the competitions thus far has been maintained.
I agree. I guess the other aspect to it is the course. We still talk about the 84 Giro, don't we, which lost some climbs and there was suspicion of Francesco Moser getting some help in a time trial from a helicopter. He got in a helicopter. No, not quite as bad as that. But we still talk about that, you know, decades on as being a kind of soft win for Moser. So I wouldn't say there's an asterisk against his victory, but it's still a talking
Give
point.
Give me some other soft wins in
well,
Grand Tours.
Well, I mean, it's not, but Bjarne Riis in 96, you know, he was a very dominant winner and there was no question. You know, again, we're talking asterisks upon asterisks here because, of course, he later confessed to doping. But at the time, again, weather affected.
One stage and he absolutely stage. Dominated
yeah,
that stage.
And had there been a closer race and had the somebody else won, perhaps there would be more of a question.
Well, there's a school
it.
Of thought that had the final time trial of Saint-Emilion been 10 kilometres longer, Jan Ulrich would have won that tour. But I think maybe a better example, Rich, well, one that no one really talks about is the 2013 Giro, which Nibali won and was quite badly weather affected in the last week. There was a whole stage that was struck off there and also climbs on another day, I seem to remember. And even the 2019 Tour de France, And there is a question mark over, well, who, I don't think people would say that it was soft, but the result might have been changed by what happened on the last 2 days in the Alps.
And a lot depends on the winner, and you know, Bernal, if he doesn't go on to win another one, it might be looked increasingly as a sort of aberration in a way, which seems unfair, but he didn't win a stage, of course. So it falls into the category of less convincing wins, even though at the time he seemed like the most deserving winner.
As we discuss this, I'm sort of imagining in 30 years' time what the Wikipedia page for the 2020 Giro d'Italia will say. And I'm wondering whether, you know, this will, in the first line, this will be, this was the COVID Giro, or will, you know, this pandemic will go on for so long that it will be self-evident that, you know, this was a race that took place in that period. We'll be desensitized to what this period in history has meant and has been. I don't know. What,
or
do you think?
Almeida wins it, but goes on to a storied and glittering career as a Grand Tour winner, and then it will be seen in a different light altogether. I mentioned I spoke to Jos van Emden today, the Dutch rider at Jumbo-Visma, a very important teammate for Stephen Kruiswijk here. He had lots of interesting things to say about the weather, about Kruiswijk's form, but also this on safeguards that are in place at the Giro to protect the riders from COVID. How does it feel, this Giro, from a health point of view? I mean, the Tour de France was pretty tightly controlled. There were lots of kind of rules and regulations about how the bubble would operate. How does the Giro feel? Do you feel like, you've obviously all had your COVID test today, but does it feel as if, you know, it's as safe as it could be?
No, for sure not. No. That already went wrong in the first hotel we were in. We were there with 4, maybe 5 teams. I don't think that's the problem, because they all know how the situation is and take care of their own health and the health of the team. But in that particular hotel we were in, the police on the motor was there. Shimano Neutral Service was there. Just normal people were there, and they were all eating from the same buffet. So I think there was that's just a real big mistake. And I heard that from someone from Quickstep, they had exactly the same. This guy sent me a little movie about their dining hall. Also, Mitchelton Scott was in that hotel. So, and now Simon Yates is infected. Yeah, for me, there's no doubt where he got the virus. It must have been there. That was just wrong. That's already like 10 teams in 2 hotels with other guests. That's not good. So let's hope it stays with only one guy infected, but maybe it gets worse and worse. The UCI should regulate this. If they want to be the head of cycling, then they should say, this is not good that you're with so many teams in one hotel, other guests. They only take care of themselves, you know, that as long as they don't get infected. That's what, how I see it. And
do you think there's a bit of complacency because the Tour, you know, did run off okay, and it was successful, and everybody stayed, all the riders stayed healthy. Do you think maybe there's a bit of complacency spread in?
Maybe, yeah, maybe. Let's hope it's not. We're all the same. We're all the same riders, and we should be protected by the people who run the sport. And we need to do all the things for them, but they don't ever do anything for us. So this is, again, a missed chance for them to show that they like us, that they don't always want to fight us. I like to see, now going ahead of the situation, but if there's more guys infected, then I hope that this UCI gets the bill. To be short, they should have said, no, RCS, this is not a good idea. There should be another solution for this.
Yeah. Well, we wait, I suppose, to hear what the results of the COVID tests are. Do you think you get them tomorrow or tonight?
I haven't heard anything about it, but I think tonight.
Right.
I guess then they will publish it tomorrow morning in the media.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwoca.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to iWoca, our title sponsor. We're very grateful indeed to them. And if you run a small business or know somebody who does, go to iwaka.co.uk to see what Iwaka can do for you. Thank you, Iwaka. We heard before the break from Jos van Emden. I mean, we're waiting to hear the COVID test results from today's tests on all the riders. But I have a feeling that it might not be the same as the Tour de France, where none of the riders test positive. But I don't know. That's just speculation. But you think that if Simon Yates had it, then, you know, and given that teams were sharing hotels and so on, there's a high possibility that others might have it too. We wait and see. Let's go into another question.
Hi, team. Chris Buck here in Glasgow. I'm really enjoying the podcasts. Great analysis of every stage, and really finding the geography and the food and drink updates very interesting as well. My question is to do with team numbering. Why is AG2R numbered first with Tony Galopin number one, when Ineos won it last year with Carapaz? Even though Carapaz isn't part of their team this year, why isn't an Ineos rider number one? Thanks.
Thanks for your question, Chris. I've been talking about this, or I've been asking about this as well, and we don't really know the answer, but I did message Larry Warbass, who, of course, lucky Larry, who rides for AG2R. He doesn't know either, really, but he has a theory, and it makes sense to me. He thinks the Giro probably aren't very happy that the previous winner isn't here, and also that Movistar, who won the race with Richard Carapaz, haven't really brought a big-name rider. The numbering system is in purely alphabetical order, whereas normally it would be number one for either the winner or the team of the previous winner. 11 would be the rider that finished second, 21 the rider that finished third, 31 the rider that finished fourth, etc., etc. And it's I guess I'm a bit confused that Nibali isn't number one, having finished second last year. But it seems to be political. So the numbers are purely alphabetical. AG2R first, and he thinks his hunch is that it's a political thing, that it's a kind of, you know, we're not happy that Richard Carapaz isn't here, so Ineos, you're not getting number one. And Movistar, we're not happy that you've not brought a big-name rider here, so you're not getting number one either. Does that seems logical, maybe?
Hi, this is Lauren Goodfellow, friend of the podcast from Matlock in Derbyshire. My question's about the leader's jersey that the leader of the Women's World Tour wears, which I think is currently being held by Lizzie Deignan. Why don't the Men's World Tour have a jersey as well? I understand that the men's calendar has a lot more races for the riders to choose between, but they still have a leader on points, I believe, on the individual ranking. So why don't they have a jersey? And do you think they should have one? Thanks for all the fantastic podcasts. It makes my commute to work a lot more interesting. Thank you.
Hi, Lauren. As I watched Gent-Wevelgem, women's Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday, and Lizzie Deignan was wearing that leader's jersey, the exact same thought occurred to me. It's quite a striking jersey. I think it's good it exists because it gives sort of meaning to that competition. Whether it's because there isn't a jersey in the Men's World Tour, the Men's World Tour doesn't have the same meaning at all.
The World Tour in the men's, as per the current men's calendar, it would be difficult to implement because you have races that overlap. So you could potentially have a situation where someone has taken first place in the rankings, but there is another race going on somewhere else in which someone is wearing the jersey, and it could get a bit complicated like that. There used to be a Pro Tour jersey, the first
and
sort of iteration.
That, a World Cup,
yeah, leader's
jersey,
the first,
yeah,
iteration of the World Tour was the Pro Tour. There used to be a Pro Tour jersey, and yeah, as you say, Rich, there was the World Cup jersey. The World Cup used to be a series of 10 one-day races that ran across the season, and it was a rainbow jersey. They were slightly different colours, weren't they, to the World Championship jerseys? But it was a vertical rainbow stripe, and I used to quite like that.
Who's leading the men's world tour?
No, Joaquin Rodriguez. Perito. He's always leading it. He's always leading it.
Okay, there we go. Tells his own story. But it's a good point about overlapping races, Daniel, because a rider might have to take his World Tour leader's jersey off mid-race if he
Not
lost
mid-stage.
The lead. Mid-stage, possibly. Anyway, let's go to another question.
Hi there, this is Steve up in beautiful Perthshire. Been really enjoying the coverage from the tour around the Giro so far this year. In particular, I really love the travelogue aspect to it and really like getting a flavour for the places that you visit. And I was looking forward to hearing how you got on in Hungary. My question is, if the general constraints of geography were not in play, what country, any country in the world, would you choose for a grand depart, for a grand tour that you could go and visit, and do you think would lend itself to some good bike racing as well? Interested to hear your thoughts. Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks, Steve. That's a great question, isn't it? I mean, I was looking forward to Hungary as well. That was definitely a thing that I was looking forward to at the start of the year. I've never been to Budapest and somewhere completely new. Portugal, you know, with the success here of Almeida and Guerreira.
It's a real shame that the Vuelta has lost its short incursion into Portugal this year because of COVID. It's a bit of an anomaly with a lack of visits to Portugal by the Vuelta in the last 20 or 30 years, and there are sort of political reasons for that. But yes, Rich, I would love to go to Portugal at a Grand Depart. There was talk of a Grand Depart for Gran Salida of the Vuelta from Porto a couple of years ago. I think that will probably happen at some point fairly soon.
Porto or Lisbon would be nice. Guerreiro, of course. I said Guerreira earlier before the pronunciation police are on to me. Where else though, Daniel? Anywhere else?
There has to be some sort of almost like editorial integrity to it. By that I mean that, if, you know, for example, with the Vuelta, I'd like to see the Vuelta go to the Balearic Islands or start in the Balearic Islands, start in the Canaries maybe. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's a bit too transparent when a country, an organisation has just stumped up a lot of money, has imposed quite a lot of, well, complications upon the race, logistical complications, as, to be honest, was the case with Israel. I didn't go, Rich. I think it got a fairly lukewarm reception from those who did. But I wasn't a huge fan of that. Also, there were political kind of misgivings for a lot of people as well. Surely, the success of ROG and POG, the only problem with a Grand Depart or whatever it may be in Slovenia, I mean, it would be perfect for Italy, is that Slovenia has magnificent mountain range, the Julian Alps, and it would be nice to show them off, which you presumably wouldn't do with the first couple of stages for a Grand Tour. There's a lot you could do in Central Europe without having to go too far, without having to impose big plane transfers.
There's a lot. I mean, we're just across the water here from Montenegro and Slovakia. You know, while Peter Sagan is still active, Lithuania. I mean, all these countries have beautiful landscapes and culture. And I was in Lithuania a few years ago, and you know, whenever you go somewhere like that, you, if you like bike race, you look at the roads with a view to what would they be like for a bike race. They would all be fantastic. And once you start, you know, opening up Eastern Europe, but it comes down to money, doesn't it? And none of these places perhaps have the sort of money that the Grand Tours are looking for.
As you say, Rich, the Balkans would be a fantastic opportunity for the Giro, in theory. I mean, we're looking out today over the Adriatic, and you feel we are pretty close to Croatia, the kind of Makarska Riviera in Croatia, and there's fantastic locations there. You're not going to imagine a Grand Depart or Grande Partenza in Split or somewhere like that. And in the Giro's case, the race could easily work its way back overland into Italy without any long transfers, really, in the course of 3 or 4 days.
Hi, guys. Laurent, Frenchman, but not living in Watford. Thank you so much for all the work you do throughout the year. It's amazing. Long time listener, long time supporter of the podcast. I look forward to more normal year again next year. My question is for Joe Dombrowski. Having gone from Team Sky with the rigidity we know of the team to Cannondale, then EF, with Jonathan Voters, as we know, it's a very different approach. And now in a kind of Italian team, morphed into a Middle Eastern one with the support of the sponsor, I'm interested in what Joe's take is on this new environment for him and how he could potentially thrive out of the new elements. Thank you very much, and looking forward to hear more of the podcast.
Thank you very much for your question, Laurent from Watford. Well, Joe Dombrowski is keeping an audio diary for us, one of six writers, and who better to answer your question? So we put it to him. We sent him the audio file of your question.
Thank you, Laurent, for your question regarding how it is going. As you said, I started my career in Sky. I spent a couple of years there. I spent now the bulk of my career in EF, very much an American team, or at least the most American team in the World Tour. And now in my first year at UAE, I have to say, there was a lot of people, I think, when it was announced that I would make the move from EF to UAE that found it a bit surprising. It was a team that was born sort of out of the ashes of Lampre, which was very much an Italian team. More so, I would say, even than EF was an American team. I mean, I would say EF is more of an international team than an American team, whereas Lampre kind of fell more in the lines of, you know, what you see also with some of the French teams. Some of them are a bit more, becoming a bit more international, like Francais de Jeux. Other teams like Direct Energy are very much, well, French. UAE, I think, is a team that is kind of in transition. And maybe that wasn't so apparent to the public from the outside. But I had a number of people that I knew and trusted that were either in the team as staff or had been in contact with the team. And, you know, everyone sort of said, you know, this team isn't, it's not Lampre anymore. It's really becoming a more international team. And they're investing a lot more in the performance side of things, which you're seeing more and more the best teams in the world, which I would say UAE is one of the best teams in the world now. There's more of that support from the kind of, I would say, performance infrastructure. You know, I think also Jumbo does that well, or has really in the last few years improved a lot. And you see that they have that support structure. Ineos was probably the team that was really groundbreaking in that sense, starting, well, almost 10 years ago now. And you saw, you know, Dave Brailsford admit after the tour that essentially other teams have caught up and really surpassed Ineos. And that there's, I would say, a war in a sense amongst the teams trying to improve in all aspects. And I think more and more you're seeing budget allocated towards essentially supporting the riders and getting the most out of the team. But I guess initially my contact with the team was with Inigo Sanmian, who lives actually in Colorado, and he knows a lot of the American riders. He was not born in the US, but he's sort of become a part of the American cycling scene. And he's the performance director at the team. So I had spoken with him actually in 2018, and I had a couple poor seasons at EF in 2017 and 18. In the end, it was like, it's difficult to take a rider who has no results. It's not exactly confidence inspiring for team managers. So I ended up signing just a 1-year contract at EF in 2019, but I felt the need to kind of get out, be in a new environment. And in 2019, I started speaking again with UAE. I had changed coaches for the 2019 season to Jim Miller, who at the time was working for Training Peaks, and he was at the team camps for UAE. And he was also really impressed with the way things were going. And I asked what he thought about it, and he was like, to be honest, I'm really bullish on this team, and I think they're going to be one of the best teams in the world in the coming years. So I saw that, and I thought, I think this is kind of a good wave to ride, and took that opportunity. And I have to say that so far, I've been really pleasantly surprised. It is still very much an Italian team in the sense that a lot of the staff and riders are Italian speaking, but I don't feel as an outsider. I mean, I would say it's becoming more and more international. Everything's been really well organized. The performance side of things, you know, I think the coaching and the medical staff is really good. We have a great nutritionist. I think it's a team that's going to continue to improve. And, you know, I felt that it was time to change from EF, and this seemed like a good fit. And of course, there's things in EF that maybe I'll miss. I mean, a lot of my friends are there. They have the most American riders. And a lot of those guys, you know, aside from bike racing, I would say are good friends of mine. And so it was always a good time, you know, around the dinner table, and sort of ambiance and morale was always good. Whereas I would say in UAE, you know, I'm probably a bit less talkative, but that's okay. You know, I'm a little bit older now. Maybe if I was a neopro, it would be a bit more difficult, and you would feel, you know, a bit less at home. It's easier, I think, to be in a team with a lot of your compatriots when you're young. But now I don't necessarily feel the need so much to have that. And obviously, it's been quite a disrupted season, and I don't think anyone's really been able to get into the full bike racing rhythm of multiple months of racing. It's very short and compressed. And even starting the Giro, there were staff that I had never worked with before this year, because before everything shut down, I had only done a couple races. But I have to say my experience thus far is quite good. And I have to say I'm pretty happy here. I think it's a good team. And I do think it's a team that's going to continue getting better and better.
Well, a very comprehensive answer there from Joe. And if any of you have questions for any of other diarists, please get in touch or send us an audio file with your question. We do like to hear your voice, as we said. Let's get on to the next question.
Hello, this is AJ Brandt from the George Garner Cycling Club in Northbrook, Illinois. I have two questions. First, with some teams not having a lot of success as usual, could there be a correlation this year with those teams having cut salaries during the COVID period? Second of all, what's up with that dog who has an accreditation to be on the Giro? Thanks.
Well, thanks for the question, AJ. Any correlation, Daniel, between teams' lack of success and salary cuts? What teams have had shockers? Well, which teams had salary cuts? There was obviously Michelin Scott.
That we know about.
Bahrain Merida, Bahrain McLaren. And I think Lotto Soudal as well possibly had a few cuts. Those are the ones we know about. Have they had particularly bad? I'm not sure that there's an obvious correlation, but I've mentioned this before. I spoke to Jack Haig during lockdown. He is joining Bahrain for next year. He's at Michelin Scott. And he did say that the salary cut did have a detrimental effect on his sense of commitment to his team. He felt like he'd entered into contract with his team and he was holding up his side of the bargain. He was training hard, all the rest of it, and they had kind of not kept their side of the bargain. Now, I mean, I have quite a bit of sympathy with that team in particular because they're very reliant on an individual, Jerry Ryan, who puts a lot of his own money into the team. I don't know whether that's fair or not, but it was an interesting insight into how psychologically it could have an effect, I think, on your loyalty, commitment to the team.
Well, I think we've seen big variations in the way teams and riders have come out of the lockdown period, and I struggle to see any real correlation with the salary cut or lack of salary cut. Just as one example, I was talking to Roberto Damiani of Cofidis, the director sportive at Cofidis, the other day. I don't believe they had any salary cuts there. And he said that Elia Viviani was absolutely exemplary during the lockdown period, trained perfectly, did absolutely everything that he was asked to do and he should have been doing, and yet it hasn't worked for him at all. And there are other teams, I think maybe you did make mistakes with the way they trained riders, or they've found out now that they've made mistakes. Others who got it spectacularly right, for example, Sunweb, which they deserve a lot of credit for, and I think in their case it was the result of a lot of agency in the way they dealt with that lockdown period, actively organising things, imposing certain types of training on the riders. But the financial aspect, it's very difficult to say, isn't it? I can't see any strong correlation.
The Sunweb case is interesting, and I spoke to Luke Roberts today, a DS there, who we'll play that at some point, that interview, but trying to dig a little bit into what exactly they did do during lockdown. I think the signs were there before lockdown, the way they started this year, but they have been the team of the second half of the season, and it'd be interesting to know what they did. And what's most remarkable, or even more remarkable in that case, is that one of the things that people worried about was the nature of the business of the sponsor. Some companies more vulnerable than others to economic conditions that were in, the effects of the pandemic on travel and so on, and they're sponsored by a travel company, and yet they've managed to somehow keep their riders very committed. Obviously, the impression you have watching them is that they've managed to remove any doubts the riders might have about the team's future. They've been signing riders for the future as well. So they've done an amazing job. And like I say, that's one for another day.
Hey guys, this is Patrick from Colorado. I'm especially enjoying your grandest tour coverage. Keep up the good work. My question is, I was watching Liège this year and I thought it was the best addition in years, mostly because the guys we were just seeing at the tour, the top names and other fun names, were at the head of the pack, like both the Slovenians, Alaphilippe, Mark Hirschi, who was the revelation of the tour. I was wondering if you guys think it would be a good idea, or possibly a cool idea, to move the Ardennes Classics to in between the tour and the Vuelta going forward each year, like possibly San Sebastian the one weekend, then Amstel the next, and then Liège the week after that. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Who knows if it's doable, of course, you know, but like, what would be reasons against it? Because in the spring, they're kind of just an afterthought of the cobbled classics that come for the weeks preceding it.
Thank you, Patrick from Colorado. It's an excellent question, isn't it? I think, because I made that point as well, that that race featured the riders who we expect to also be challenging for the Tour de France. And unfortunately, in recent years, in the past, that's what Liège-Bastogne-Liège used to be. It was where the classic specialists and the Grand Tour riders came together, or in many cases, they were the same riders. That's not happened so much, partly because of timing, and a lot of the guys who are focusing on the Grand Tours are away at altitude camps often. How do we get them all together? Because it was a great race, and it was because all those riders were there and in great form.
Yes, Richard, I think that slot after the Tour de France, before the Vuelta for the Ardennes Classic, might make quite a lot of sense from the point of view of the weather. I know in Belgium there's a lot of influence and a lot of vested interests behind sort of having this big block of racing in the spring in Belgium. The TV companies are very attached to it, the media are very attached to it, but I think it sometimes works against Belgian cycling. I've spoken to race organisers before, and they've said that it's very difficult to exist outside those few weeks in the spring. So to have a sort of second intense period of racing, second helping of classics later in the year, might be good for a lot of people there as well. I'm sure there are other considerations, there are other obstacles that people would suggest exist, other things happening in other sports, for example, the football season starting again and so on and so forth. You know, what do we currently have in that period, in that window? We currently have San Sebastian, whose prestige I feel has sort of faded in recent years.
But I wonder if it could be almost amplified by the proximity of other similar kinds of races, because it is a race also that's hilly and suits a similar kind of rider, and it comes so close after the Tour, you know, often 6 days after the Tour has ended, that it's doesn't often attract the riders who've ridden the Tour. However, if it was followed by Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the next week, then maybe, you know, riders would look on that little block as worth committing to and peaking for. The other issue, I mean, we haven't talked about this at all, but, you know, usually it's not so much a thing now, but it still happens that there's a lucrative round of post-tour That's criteriums. True. And I guess that a lot of them didn't happen this year. And that could be a reason, again, why Tadej Pogacar, in particular, went on to the World Championships and then did so well at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, rode Flèche Wallonne as well. But I wonder if in a normal year, and you had those races immediately afterwards, whether they'd be compromised by riders going on that criterium circuit and picking up some checks.
Another race I'd throw into the mix, Rich, would be Strade Bianche. I don't think it really necessarily goes where it's traditionally in the calendar now. So before San Remo, before Tirreno Adriatico, it's a funny race. We still, after over 10 years now, we're not, I think, fully clear on what kind of rider it suits. It almost suits anyone really who can be strong in a 1 day race over 200 kilometers. But I thought it looked great when it was rescheduled for the summer this year, and it's more to my mind anyway, it's a race that suits Ardennes riders at least as much as it does cobbled classics riders.
I'm sure one legacy of this year will be that some organizers and maybe even the UCI look afresh at where some of these races are and really ask questions that they perhaps haven't asked.
Yeah, and I suppose you have to ask the question, does it make sense? I mean, to my mind, from a narrative point of view, it makes sense to have different compartments to the season. So you have almost a 1 week stage race season, you have a Ardennes Classics type season, you have a cobble classics type season. I think it helps the fan to sort of get their bearings, and you get these natural kind of crescendos in those micro periods, or which we've sort of had almost by default this year. But do you need regular 1 week stage races sort of sprinkled around the season in order to help riders prepare for Grand Tours? I mean, one question we were asking ourselves the other day is what the small Spanish teams are doing to prepare for the Vuelta, because they've not had any racing really in the last couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, or nothing of any real note. So sometimes, as we all know, these races exist mainly because of their relationship to bigger races coming further down the line.
G'day guys, Andrew from New Zealand here. I'm best friend of the podcast. I absolutely love it. It's compulsory listening for me in New Zealand winters with the Grand Tours, a little bit into the New Zealand spring now. And around about this time of year, I use the podcasts as lullabies to help me get to sleep. And the soothing tones of Lionel, Daniel, Richard, and Francois certainly helped me get fantastic sleeps after only a couple of minutes of listening. Anyway, my comment and question is mainly about Peter Sagan and the question of where has his form gone. And to me, it seems quite clear that his form went probably about 2 years ago in the Tour de France on the day that he crashed heavily on the Col d'Azay on that short stage. And I remember he took quite a hit on his bum. He had the green jersey sewn up and decided that to come out the next day and smash it over the Tourmalet and up the Aubisque. And since then, you know, the Vuelta, he was came nowhere. He was not very good at the World Champs. The Classics the next year, he just ran out of puff. And he's never regained that form that he had 2 years ago at the Tour de France and before that. I wonder if these crashes that riders have, the serious crashes, whether continuing to ride day after day can cause permanent damage. And sometimes it's better for them to have a crash which causes them to retire from the race, such as, say, Wout van Aert had a year ago. Keen for your thoughts, guys. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. Very speculative, so Lionel would not approve of it at all. Did Sagan lose something the day that he crashed on that very short stage of the grid-style start that was won by Nairo Quintana, if you remember? It sticks in my memory because it's the only time Sagan has ever crashed. I mean, he crashed at Tour of Flanders, you know, going uphill, but it's the only time I can recall him having a serious crash, which is a sort of testament to his bike handling skills, given all the finishes that he contests and the bunch sprints he's involved in. I don't know is the answer, and I guess that would be a question for Sagan himself. Has he lost his edge? I mean, he's been at the top for a long, long time now, and if there is a kind of diminishing of his powers, I think it's been very gradual and for a very, very long time. You know, when he rode his first tour in 2012, he was sort of unbeatable, but also an unknown quantity. And when he lost that element of surprise and became the most marked man in the sport, it became much harder for him to win. And I think maybe the rest of it is just the process of aging and the fact that he's been doing this for so long.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the number of second places he's had, and that's when you realise how fine the margins are, and you realise that whether seasons or periods of his career are categorised as a success or failure can depend purely on the emergence of another rider who's better than him on a certain type of terrain. And you could probably identify three or four riders who have put quite a dent in his palmarès over the last few years. Maybe even Julian Alaphilippe is one in big races. I don't know off the top of my head how many times Sagan has finished second to him, but in races like San Remo, someone like Julian Alaphilippe has probably changed the way that Sagan has approached the race and has approached things like the Poggio. It often comes down to that. I think over the last 15-20 years, there have been times when the sprinting field has been relatively stronger and weaker. I think there have been windows of opportunity where riders have won a lot of races over a period of a couple of years when maybe there's been a bit of a power vacuum. Again, who's to say that the sort of ebb and flow of Sagan's career hasn't said more about who he's up against than what he's actually doing? Because I think one remarkable thing about Sagan is how unbelievably consistent he's been. His off-colour periods, he's been finishing second, third and fourth. He's not been finishing eighth, ninth, tenth, twelfth. And I think there could still be an Indian summer. I suppose the one thing with him that we always get the sense of is this kind of ennui, this kind of almost boredom, apathy. But I don't know whether that's more in his kind of communication style than it is in the way he actually provokes his riding. Yeah, really. And also he's always fit at races. He never shows up. I mean, he never really shows up overweight or unfit or untrained or not ready, which suggests that he still has enough motivation to prepare for races.
I think he'll win Milan-San Remo when he's no longer a favourite to win Milan-San Remo.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off, I'm not even going to bother asking you tonight, Daniel. If you want 25% off your Science in Sport products...
We had a long conversation about sports nutrition at breakfast, actually.
Yes, we did. With Gregor Brown over there.
Yes.
Well, there was a lot of talk, tech talk as well. I mean, you were showing...
Disc brakes, well, aluminium frames.
I had a message from Lizzie Banks today, who hosts Service Corps, saying that she'd been listening back to episode one of our Grandest Tour coverage all the way back in Palermo, with you asking all these tech questions. She was asking if you'd like to guest host an episode of Service Corps.
What tech questions was I asking?
You were asking about...
Oh, the riders, yeah.
Yeah, all kinds of things. Really getting into that, aren't you? Anyway, back to Science and Sport. Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting us. Go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code, discount code, SISCP25 at the checkout for 25% off. Let's go to another question.
Hello, gents. Brendan here from Dublin. I'm really enjoying the Giro coverage, so thanks for that. I just wonder if you could say something about how the pro cyclists transition from cycling with their team, where everything is laid on for them and everything is looked after, as it were, to when they're cycling in, say, the World Championships for their country. Do they have the same bicycle? Do they have the same gear generally? Do they have the same soigneur, same mechanic? Just wondering how all of that works.
Thanks for your question, Brendan. It's an interesting one, and we thought we'd put it to one of the riders who is keeping an audio diary for us and who rode at the World Championships recently, James Knox of De Koenig Quickstep. Here's his response to your question.
Simple, but it's complicated. I'm there and supported by Great Britain the entire time, but everything needs to be organised with the different trade teams. So a truck from De Koenig Quickstep came down, came somewhere near Imola before I arrived. A GB mechanic went and collected all my stuff, and then the GB mechanic was then responsible for my bike. My Sosa and Swanier's are responsible for preparing all the food. I used combination of, I had some of my own, so we used 60 products, I had some used 60 and then some of the SIS. So, you know, like just making do with what you can, basically. And then at the end of the race, there's quite a few team trucks and stuff collected around. So I had to drop off my bike and wheels directly. Well, actually, I didn't finish. I pulled out when I got dropped before I left to go. I gave my bike back to the team. And then they drove a day later to the Giro. It's a bit of a mess, to be honest. There's lots of emails sent backwards and forwards. And the worst thing about it all is you don't know if you're selected to ride until a week before, something like this. So I was still in Tirreno, I think. Last day Tirreno, I found out I was riding. That's a little inside of you.
Well, interesting there from James. Let's move on to another question, shall we?
Hey, guys. This is Eric, friend of the podcast from Michigan in the United States. And I just had a question or comment about the perception of Team Ineos this year and their struggles in the Grand Tours. I believe Daniel said something about them being in the unfamiliar position about not having someone at the sharp end of the race with Thomas's withdrawal. But I'm curious as to how much this is actually reflected in Ineos or Sky's Grand Tour history in Grand Tours, not the Tour de France. Going back to 2011 at the start of the team, since that time, I believe they've had two podium finishes in the Giro d'Italia with Chris Froome's win in 18 and then Rigoberto Urán's second place in 2013. And apart from these, they also had three other occasions where they had riders finish in the top 10 with Urán and Hinault in 2012 and Leopold Koenig, I believe, in 2015 or 2016. And this is hardly reflective of a team that dominates or even does well in a Grand Tour. I believe Vincenzo Nibali or Domenico Pozzovivo probably have as many top 10s in that time in the Giro as Team Sky / Ineos did. And looking at the Vuelta, it is slightly better, but it still is very much a one-man show where either Chris Froome does well or the team struggles. And just curious what implications this has for the team going forward without Chris Froome's involvement. Are we going to see a team much more with feet of clay and much more like other teams? And are we really overlooking the enduring quality of teams like Astana and Movistar, who have done remarkably consistent in Grand Tours, in tours such as the Giro and the Vuelta, even though they may not have had as many wins in the Tour de France? Anyways, thanks for the coverage and look forward to the next 2 weeks.
Thanks, Eric in Michigan, for your question about Team Ineos. Feet of clay. Do we, I mean, he's talking in particular about the Giro and the Vuelta and Team Sky, Team Ineos's record in those races. It isn't great. I mean, they have dominated the Tour de France. That's pretty significant. That counts for a lot. Has it been at the expense of those races? And do we almost overestimate the force of Ineos Sky as a Grand Tour team?
Well, I think we've always assumed, partly because Froome came after Wiggins, that that organisation, Sky, Ineos, have elevated Froome rather than Froome elevating them. But maybe we'll revise that slightly when we look back on this amazing period of dominance in 2 or 3 years, and we see how they fare in the next couple of years when Froome has gone. You can't accuse them of not taking the Giro seriously. They went there with Richie Porte and they put him in a motorhome. I mean, they took it very seriously. But I think there's always been a sense, and some of it's subliminal and it's not communicated, but there's a sense that the Tour de France is their raison d'etre, and there is never quite the same tension, the kind of sense of life or death about the Giro. Even someone like Richie Porte went to the Giro knowing that his biggest job of the year really was in the next race, the Tour de France. And I think that's possibly permeated the spirit they've taken into the Giro. And that's not anyone's fault necessarily. It's just the way it is. The Tour has always been the most important thing for them. And then the Vuelta, as we all know, it's a place where you can make up for what's not gone right at the Tour de France, or you can put an extra sort of cherry on the cake. And that's been the case for Sky and Ineos, hasn't it? And again, Froome is the one that's shown the way with his incredible determination, and he is someone who I think has gone into every big objective with the spirit that it is not quite life or death, but that he's going to go to win and compete to win in those Grand Tours, whether it be the Vuelta, the Tour, whatever. But again, maybe that's said more about him than it has about the team.
It's interesting you mentioned Movistar, because in its previous guys that was Benesto, and it's interesting to look at how they dealt with the loss of injury when he retired, and after not winning the 96 Tour, he retired, and they were always looking around for the next injury, and they tried Abraham Olano and riders like that. Alex Zula as well was there, and they never really struck gold in the same way. And it wasn't until Alejandro Valverde emerged that they had a new talisman, but a different kind of rider. Often a team's success does depend on having that supreme talent and personality. Team Sky Ineos have had 4 Tour de France winners, Geraint Thomas and Egan Bernal being the most recent ones. But whether they can have that sustained success again with a rider, there will only be one dominant rider. That you talk a lot, Daniel, about dynasties, and we're in this transitional period at the moment where we don't know who the next dominant rider will be, but one will emerge, you would imagine, because that's always happened in the past. Whatever team he's on, that'll be the team that he's on, and they will build something around him, and it could be Jumbo-Visma, it could be UAE Team Emirates, or it could be Ineos. Whether Ineos, that means that they have to go out and buy Pogacar or something, they may well do that, or the next dynasty might belong to another rider on another team.
Has Ineos, and this I think comes from, if it's true, it comes from Dave Brailsford, are they less interested than other teams in competing, fighting for a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth place? I just wonder, because we all know, it's no secret that Brailsford has been very single-minded, and he is someone who wants to win. I talk about that kind of latent sort of tension, adrenaline that you kind of sense around Ineos and other teams when they're competing for a victory. With Ineos, I've always felt that when plan A goes awry, it's almost as though the air just, it doesn't slowly leak out of the balloon. The balloon just punctures, and you kind of feel it in the energy around the team. They're not really, I've never really felt they're that interested in competing for a third or fourth or fifth place with their second leader or their deputy leader. That, that's sort of COD psychology, fag packet theories on my part.
I mean, you could say at the Tour and now at the Giro, they've lost their leader and then gone hunting for stages with quite a lot of dynamism, but I think that depends on the riders. Filippo Ganna here is a young, up-and-coming rider for whom a stage win means a lot. And at the Tour de France, I think, the way that Carapaz rode in his first Tour, there was a lot at stake, a lot on the line for him. But it depends on the personalities, doesn't it? And for some of them, a stage win isn't going to mean enough.
And when you're accustomed to winning Grand Tours and winning the Tour de France, it's natural that it's going to be difficult to get quite as excited and get really motivated about, you know, even putting a second string or third string rider on the podium or in third or fourth or fifth place.
Well, Daniel, we better end it there because we have to go for dinner. And that's very important.
That's a great consolation to those who sent in great questions. A lot of great questions that we haven't got to, but we will get to some of them later.
I'm looking at a pile of questions here. I'm really sorry. We haven't had time to get through them all. We don't want to give people.
Do we save them? Do we have a rollover?
We could have a rollover. There are some good ones in there, and we haven't got to them. Some of them require a bit more research as well. That's another issue. Some of them require us to actually go out there and do a bit of work.
Well, I've been working all day. What have you been doing?
Well, we've both been working all day, but we've been working on other things.
In different ways.
There's not been time. Well, we're sharing a computer
at
the moment, so it's difficult. My desktop was really tidy.
And no, it's not anymore. I know. I intend to clean it up for you.
It looks like the Stelvio.
You've got some absolute gold on there now. You could sell some of those files.
Thanks, Daniel. Excellent. Well, it's for Kilometre Zero you've been working on. When are we going to see that?
You're going to hear it tomorrow, I hope.
Hear it, yeah. What's it on?
Italy's third mountain race. Third, not in size, not in length, but in importance in conversations about the Giro.
Very cryptic, Daniel. Well, listen, as promised, you're going to sing us out with a song to mark the 1,000th episode.
I'm not going to sing us out, Richard. I'm going to wish us a very, very heartily wish us a happy 1,000th episode.
And here's the next 1,000.
Promise that
where will we be in another 1,000 episodes? Yeah. What will we be doing?
Yeah, we will toast. You know what will we do, Richard? We will do what do the Italians say? A toast. What was the word? You remember?
Oh God!
You don't even have to remember a word. Just remember a place. It's a place name.
Oh, I'll pronounce it wrong, though, won't I? You have to remind me. Sorry.
We were there the other day.
I know.
It was in It was in Puglia.
Yeah, I know where it was. Because of B.
Yeah, yeah.
I. S.
You've got some, yeah. You.
A.
No.
E.
Brin.
Brindisi.
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 We'll do a Brindisi to the 1,000th episode.
Okay, well, anyway, thanks very much to you listeners, because without you, there wouldn't have been 1,000 episodes. We're very grateful to you for all your feedback, support, criticism. Not really, we don't like that. And your questions, keep the questions coming. I'm sure we'll do another press
and
conference.
And a final apology to our American listeners about the
if
whole
you're still listening.
Risotto gate.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.